doesn't have the header. Right. So the line numbers aren't right.
Oh, my line. Sorry. Sorry, I laughed so loud. Bribery does not work in this committee. Member Senator Lori, sorry. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Tuesday, April the 7th. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum present. The first amendment on the agenda, the first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1890, which is Senator Lori's bill. And we have passed out to you the A2 amendment. Senator Betzel, move the A2 amendment.
After.
And then we will have Senator Lori explain the need for the A2 amendment, which is Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1890 is a federal health information technology incentives. It's really getting Minnesota's statutes in line and ready to get as much of the federal stimulus money in the health information technology as we possibly can. And really the only section that brought us here is Section 1, Subdivision 6. The Commissioners of Health and Human Services collect some data. None of it is personal data whatsoever. And so we had a data classification section, but with the amendment, we would eliminate that data classification section.
What does de-identified form mean?
So, members, do you understand the A2 amendment? We're moving that section, and we're deleting the only section that has brought this bill to us.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
I'm struggling with the word de-identified.
It's okay.
It's okay, it's Senator okay. Lori says.
Before right now. Change it. It's this. She just goes up saying questions. So...
just a comment.
Sorry. Just a comment on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment then has taken out the information in Senate File 1890 that makes it, brought it to our jurisdiction. Thereby, we will send Senate File 1890 on its way. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1890 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Yes? Do you go to finance or you go to the floor?
I do.
Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lori.
De-identified.
Senator Clark.
It's pretty quick. Hopefully I don't have any unidentified or misidentified words. Excuse my voice.
Why just say
you have to pull the microphone really close to you.
Especially with my voice
yes.
right now.
Yes. Let's see. Senate File 1712. Senator Clark.
Madam Chair, members, there's actually one oral amendment, and I'm wondering if I could just do that very quickly, and then I can explain the bill. On line 6.8, in parenthesis, there is the letter N, which would mean there was a lot more powers there than there exist in this draft, and so we need to delete that and insert G, the letter G.
Mm. So on line 6.8, delete the letter N and insert the letter G. That sounds like it's a Senator Higgins amendment. On Senator Higgins, move that oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Humphrey fellow Michelle Gray brought the idea for this bill to me a couple years ago. Before she was married, her husband was deployed. A relative with attorney-in-fact responsibilities took advantage of this arrangement. Tens of thousands of dollars were stolen from him while he served honorably overseas. We've been working with the Guard the past few years to find the right language and the scope for a new power of attorney form which would protect soldiers while deployed. This legislation changes the power of attorney statute in form to place the more restrictive powers granted to the attorney in fact first. It does this by requiring an accounting of the attorney in fact actions unless specifically waived. The form requires the signature of the attorney in fact and lists the standard of conduct and penalty for abuse.
Madam Chair, there's a lot of discussions going on around the area here.
For people in the room, could you please take the conversations outside into the hallways, please? Thank you. Thank you, Senator Betzel. Senator Clark?
There's a lot of interest in your cart. The statute introduces a penalty phase for a violation of the statute. The penalties are defined in current statutes for fraud and theft. The legislation is tailored to a member of the military who is stationed outside the state of Minnesota. The bill also offers an expiration date, which is determined when the principal is no longer in active duty military service. I have with me Colonel Allness, who actually is not planning on speaking unless you have any questions for him, but also Captain Kristen Desjardins, an attorney with the Minnesota National Guard, will talk about the impact on soldiers and their families and may have some answers to questions you might have.
Okay. Captain Desjardins, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I believe the effect on the service members is a positive one, specifically the fact that they have to sign that they accept these duties and responsibilities, and the fact that their criminal liability is specifically stated on the form, so they are fully aware of what their responsibilities are at the time of accepting. The other benefit to the service members is that it automatically expires on return from deployment. The other one does not currently do that. And if there is not an expiration date specified, it may be indefinite and may be used indefinitely. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members, you know, this is Colonel Allness and I have been working on some warrior to citizen kinds of activities for a while now, and this is yet another one of the provisions and ideas that came from members. We've been trying to make sure both as our men and women are being deployed and then as they return home that we're thinking about what are the impacts of some of our current laws and rules on their in their families' lives. And in all honesty, this is one of those areas that we really have seen some family members take advantage of people. Now, there perhaps should be a longer-term conversation at some point about our power of attorney. That this bill does not do that. It is specifically about active duty members who are not in Minnesota.
Senator Betzel. Well,
Madam Chair, I do have a question on the expiration date. It's not true that they're indefinite because you can put a time period on, say they'll expire in 1 year or 2 years. But this says that at the bottom of page 7, it's effective only when the principal is a member of the active service station outside of Minnesota. It expires when the principal is no longer in active military service. So if an agent comes to me and has this filled out, how do I know whether the person is still in the active service and is still outside of the state of Minnesota? I may not know that, and there's nothing on the document that's going to tell me that. If it had an expiration date, that I could figure out, but I would not know the other part. So how would somebody be able to accept this power of attorney and knowing whether it's good or not, given this expiration date language?
Captain Desjardins.
Thank you, Senator. It is correct that if there's an expiration date on it, it is not indefinite. However, as a judge advocate, there are frequently times when service members do not want to put an expiration date on there. Secondly, I don't know that as a vendor you would know specifically if this individual is back in the state if you do not check the registry. There is a public access registry to find out whether or not individuals are still on active duty. And if you were to check that, you would be able to find that. If not, then the only other way is if you call the unit and ask them.
Well, Senator Betzel, Chair and Captain, is there somewhere on this document that would indicate where the person's unit is, or how you could verify that? I don't see that.
Well, you could actually ask the individual that's trying to exercise the power of attorney first off. And I think it would be a little more work to try and find the specific unit. You could always call, go to the website and find a number for the Staff Judge Advocate Office. We could provide that information. Any of the units could provide any of that information of whether or not where that person is located. The other thing that it does is it actually, in the event that it would expire and the attorney in fact would attempt to use it after the individual has returned, that does subject them to further liability.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
I think that Senator Betzold's bringing up a good point. I'm wondering if counsel could help us in subdivision three of adding where the website where or the location where the registry can be found, because that way, at least on the form, that would be on there. I mean, I do think it's a little, while it may be for a vet, from a vendor standpoint.
Ms. Pontius, can you maybe reflect a little bit on Senator Betzel's question to see if there's already something in the bill that could address that?
Madam Chair and members, well, there's a provision in current law under which an attorney, in fact, can actually execute an affidavit that's basically verifying that they still that the power of attorney is still valid, that they still have authority. That applies under general law, and I think would apply here as well. And then a person who relies on that affidavit then is protected. So I'm guessing in most of these cases, people would probably be asking for that separate affidavit from the attorney, in fact. So if you look in, I think it's Section 3 of the bill, it kind of references that affidavit there. So it's if they have executed an affidavit setting forth the conditions precedent to their authority to act, a person who relies on that then is protected. And so if, in fact, the attorney, in fact, were to allege things in the affidavit that weren't true, if in fact the person was no longer in active military service, then there'd be a cause of action against the attorney in fact. And there's actually an affidavit form in another section of the law that doesn't appear in the bill. Because sometimes even like when an attorney, power of attorneys normally don't have an expiration date, sometimes just as a matter of course, I think some businesses will ask for just an update affidavit from the attorney in fact, verifying that the power of attorney is still valid.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
I think the other thing is on page 7, under the acknowledgement of attorneys in fact, if I'm the person who's the attorney in fact, I've signed this scene on the same page that this is only as good until the person is out of the military. So I'm the one that has that knowledge, and I mean, I think that that's what we're really trying to do is put some constraints around that person.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Clark, this bill reminds me of over 20 years ago when I was in the Air Force JAG and we used to do exercises where we'd call people in the middle of the night and fill these out, so it brings back some memories. But
sounds like torture, Madam
Chair. But what I'm wondering about, I had the same concern as Senator Betzold because I've used these documents before where someone's signing, and I don't think most of the, whether it's a bank or an insurance company or anyone else you might be dealing with, is going to want to start making phone calls or really putting themselves out and generally is going to require something in writing rather than any kind of confirmation or something that they might find online or whatever. Now maybe what Ms. Pontius has pointed out will take care of that, but I do think we should think through maybe some of the unintended consequences if we might make this a more difficult tool to use for people who are using it in a way they would want to have it used. And then the other thing, Senator Clark, that I was going to ask you is on that subdivision 3 on page 7. I'm not clear because the first sentence says that it's only effective when the person is a member of the military in active service and stationed outside the state of Minnesota. But then the second sentence says that it expires when the principal is no longer in active military service. So is that a conflict or does it mean that you know it would stay sort of in abeyance while the person was back here but not outside the state state and then become reactivated if they were outside the state again, or how were you expecting those two sentences to work together?
Captain Desjarlais?
Yes, Madam Chairperson.
Captain, why don't you think on that? And I've asked Ms. Pontius, maybe because we have this attorney in fact language that's in current law, and then we're adding this other alternative to it. And I've asked Ms. Pontius, maybe she could do a comparison for us, so she can briefly talk to us what current law does, and then what it is that we're trying to do differently or in addition to with Senate File 1712. Perhaps that could provide a basis for us to think about the proposed language that's in here. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and members, I think you've already been discussing one of the big differences from the general law, which is the expiration. Normally, a power of attorney doesn't expire unless there's a date actually put in the document itself. So this would be an automatic expiration. It would be tied to their military service. Another difference is just in the kinds of powers that can be delegated under this attorney. In fact, it's not as broad as what's under the general law. It doesn't include real property transactions, bond, share, and commodity transactions, beneficiary, gift, and fiduciary transactions, family maintenance, and benefits from military service, and with respect to insurance transactions, it doesn't include life insurance transactions. And also, too, I think as was mentioned earlier, there's a special acknowledgement by the attorney in fact, which if you look at page 7 of the bill, under current law, the attorney in fact does not actually sign the power of attorney. There's a line where they can have, which is optional, where they just have a sample of their signature, but they don't in any way actually execute that document. So this would require a formal, like notarized acknowledgement from the attorney in fact. And I think a lot of it is just intended to really highlight to them the fact that they may be subject to civil or criminal liability, you know, for misuse of the power of attorney. Another difference is that it's not effective if the principal becomes incompetent or incapacitated, so it's not what's called a durable power of attorney, which is what the general short form is. So if they do become incompetent or incapacitated, then it's not valid.
Okay. Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pontius. Senator Clark?
Well, and I think, you know, again, a big part of the reason why we came forward with this was because of actions of some attorneys, in fact. So this is really about them saying, yes, I'm accepting this responsibility, and then acknowledging that they understand what consequences there could be to them if they misuse their powers. So I think that's the big thing to be looking at here, Senator Olson. And then I think on as to your other question, if you look back on page 7.36 and 7.37, if we would mirror the language before the period that you have on 7.36, the principal is no longer in active military service outside the state of Minnesota. That's what we're really looking for. Okay. That was a good question.
Senator Clark, was there a reason? I thought that the reason why we needed to do this is because some of our military personnel were being stationed outside of the United States and not just in another state, because being out of the United States presents some other barriers, and that if somebody was a Minnesota resident, but say they were in Fort Hood in Texas or at another military base in the United States, that they could, I mean, there was easier access and communication, whereas if they were stationed somewhere abroad, that was harder. And the reason why we wanted to do this was to take care of the ones who were abroad. And yet here we say anybody outside of Minnesota. And so is this open it up too broadly to military personnel that are Minnesotans but spread throughout other parts of the United States? Captain?
Madam Chair. I can speak from personal experience on this. My husband is currently deployed. Right now he's in Washington. And it would seem that because he's on an active duty post, he would just be able to walk down to the local JAG office and get something like this executed. However, that's not the case. He's on 24-hour missions. He's training 12 to 18 hours a day. He has very limited time for him to go down and access the SJA's office, the Staff Judge Advocate office. So this, having executed this prior to him leaving, would have been a benefit for me. It would have been a lot less stressful on me to have him try to make time to go down there and interrupt his training, at which point, if he doesn't complete all the training, he might be held after, et cetera, et cetera. That is one case that I think that this verbiage is a benefit to us, the service members.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Clark?
Your understanding is correct. I mean, the intent is about people who are going to be stationed overseas. But when we were looking at limiting to that, the question became, what if they are being deployed and go from Washington or go to a different, they move around a fair amount first. Now, we could certainly say where the intent is they're going to go overseas, but what happens if somebody actually doesn't end up? I mean, there was enough of differences there, and if members have another idea, but that's the reason why it was expanded.
I understand. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I was going to just add some more information on that point and then go back to the earlier point about the expiration date. I know because my son is over in Iraq right now that that's generally how it works, and a lot of people, they generally go to another state for a while for training, and then they're ultimately deployed overseas. The same way on the return, they're usually somewhere else in another state for a couple of weeks before they come back to Minnesota. So it's kind of a process. And then the other suggestion I was going to make about the expiration date is I understand one of the purposes is you want to put some more teeth in the law so that these instruments aren't misused. But I don't think you want to create a barrier for people who want to use them legitimately. So maybe there could be some language that says something like a copy of the person's orders or something there'll be a presumption that if this is accompanied by a copy of their orders, you know, that the person can rely on that, the person who's accepting this. I don't know exactly what the right language would be, but that might, then the person who, if they misused it, would still be liable because they would know that they were misusing it, but the person accepting it would have something concrete to rely on, just as a suggestion.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I honestly don't know if this legislation is going to really cure or correct anything. I've cranked out, I'm a retired JAG officer myself, and I've cranked out lots of power of attorneys over the years, and in fact, you know, I don't know what the current program from the Judge Advocate General School is, but they had a program that was designed so that you could, you know, put one very fairly quickly, and it's for use in almost every state. The flaw, the whole problem with the whole idea of power of attorneys, who do you give it to? And I mean, there were years ago when the first sergeant said everybody's going to have a power of attorney. So two guys would look at each other and said, "Okay, I guess I'll give one to you, and you give one to me." That's not a good idea. That's a license to steal. One of my former colleagues talked about during Vietnam, a young man gave a power of attorney to a woman he trusted. He went off to Vietnam, came back home. She sold everything he had, emptied out his bank accounts, everything. It was his mother. His mother had the power of attorney, and she cleaned him out. So who you give this to matters more than anything else. And this can revise the form, but I you know, if they still give it to the wrong person, that's not going to correct the underlying problem. So I did meet with Colonel Alness earlier this year, and I did talk about the fact that a lot of the things that were in the short power of attorney probably did not need to be in a power of attorney that a typical service member signs. So that's been shortened up. But I still have questions whether or not this is really going to accomplish its intended purpose as opposed to the normal power of attorney.
Well, Senator Betzel, I think that you're absolutely right in that at the end of the day, it's the person who this is given to that matters. But since we can't legislate that, we can do the best that we can with what we have in front of us. And I would think that this is probably the best that we can do from a legislative standpoint. So, Any further discussions on Senate File 1712? Anybody else here who would like to be heard on Senate File 1712 as amended? Senator...
Madam Chairperson? I just have one last question.
Captain.
Yes, ma'am. The one thing that the civil and criminal liability section does do for service members is I know talking to my brother-in-law who's active duty Air Force, he when he was over in Iraq, he had the exact same situation as his wife cleaned him out and left the house and et cetera, et cetera. And I talked to him about this, and he said that he would feel a little bit more comfortable about it had he known that there were criminal liabilities, because now what he's being told is, yeah, that's too bad. She's your wife. You gave her power of attorney. That's too bad. So I think it would give service members who elected to utilize it a peace of mind. Thank you.
But
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Captain, again, if this person gave somebody else a power of attorney, you're authorizing this person to do those things. How can they be civilly or criminally liable if I gave that person the power of attorney? Even under the revised language here, I don't see that there's a difference.
It's not actually liable. Even bad faith.
Senator Olson.
I think we should amend the language that Senator Clark mentioned. I don't think we've moved that language. On line 3.37, after the word service, insert outside the state of Minnesota. I think that was the phrase that Senator Clark, the amendment she suggested.
Where is that?
3.37?
No, 7.37. Right?
Oh, excuse me, 7.37, yes. So that the two sentences are consistent, the two sentences in that subdivision?
They're actually different concepts.
Senator Olson, I believe that they're different concepts. So the outside of the state of Minnesota is taken care of with the first sentence?
Well, Madam Chair, I think this was the amendment that Senator Clark suggested, because the intent would be that it would expire when they return to the state of Minnesota. I think that's what Senator Clark said was her intent. Yes, yeah, she's saying yes.
Oh,
yes,
so the power of attorney expires when the principal is no longer in active military service in Minnesota?
Outside the state of Minnesota.
Outside of Minnesota.
Then you don't need the first sentence.
I guess Ms. Pontius...
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, then actually the first sentence becomes moot, because that was intended to sort of suspend the power of attorney when they go in and out of the... So I think then all you need is the second sentence to say it expires when they're no longer in active military service outside of Minnesota.
That's fine. Just try to clarify what Senator Olson brought up before.
Well...
I mean, you can have both in. It doesn't hurt, but...
Okay. Well, Ms. Yeah. Madam Chair, Ms. Pontius, I guess that's kind of what I was asking Senator Clark, is what the intent was, if it was supposed to just be sort of in hiatus while they go when they go in and out. And she suggested this language. So, again, now I'm sort of really confused. But I suppose you could do it either way. You could have it just end when the person comes back to the state of Minnesota, or you could say it's just suspended during that time, and it would just be a question of what the author's intending.
Senator Clark, you intend, so long as they're in active military service, you want it to be in effect. If they should, in that active military service, though, be going in and out of the state,
right,
you still want it to be in effect, yes?
The intent is to...
Not expired. Yeah. Active duty is what anchors it.
What we were really coined after is about when people are being deployed. And when they come back home, it would no longer be in effect, because if they're here, they don't need an attorney effect anymore.
Well,
in fact, anymore.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, but they can, I mean, we've seen redeployments.
Right.
And so
the thought was
it seems to me, I agree with Chair, active military service seems to be the linchpin here for, you know, when it would no longer be, because this is a military short form. Am I correct? That's what it's called?
Madam Chair?
Statutory short form for military.
Thing Senator Clark?
Is that it doesn't, it is not in effect when the member is inside the state of Minnesota. I mean, that's very important, and it could be a little confusing to someone about when it exists. I would think they would just sign a new attorney, in fact, when they go overseas again.
So, Senator Clark, when Senator Olson's son came home for a two-week visit, that, I mean, he did one of these. He went to Iraq. He's home for a two-week visit.
Right.
and knowing that he's going to go back, he'll have to re-execute another one.
I
was asking you.
Yes. The intent would not be for that, but we'd have many men and women who are coming home for a year, year and a half, or 2 years, and then you would not apply.
But if you were home for a year or 2 years, then you would cease to be an active military service.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Captain?
Ma'am, it really depends on the status that individual is. We do have active military service within the state of Minnesota. It's called Active Guard and Reserve, which is Title 32 active duty, and so they may be on that. So what this is really talking about is if you're on military deployment orders outside of the state of Minnesota, this power of attorney would be in effect. If you came back for 2 weeks on hiatus, it would be suspended temporarily. Okay. If you are redeployed, then it would be in full force and effect again. The problem that I see a lot of times is when soldiers come through at the soldier readiness processing, which is called the SRP, I ask them, have you ever had a power of attorney before? Well, I don't know. I might have had one at my last deployment. Well, do you know where that is? No, I really don't. Do you know if you had an expiration date on it? Yeah, I don't think I did. So they don't know, and this would alleviate that.
All right. So then Senator Olson's amendment would be in order if that's the intent here. Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, it says when the person is on active duty and stationed outside of the state, if the person's home is on leave, they're still stationed somewhere else. They just happen to be gone from their duty station at the time and happen to be, you know, back in Minnesota. I think that the language here asks the vendor to determine, is the person in active duty and where are you stationed? I think we ought to just eliminate the stationed part. If the person happened to be stationed back here because they're a recruiter or they happen to be stationed back in Minnesota for whatever reason, I mean, if you're in Minnesota, you should be able to take charge of your own affairs, but that should not be the vendor's duty to figure out where the person is stationed. You're either active duty or not active duty, and I think that might simplify the matter if that's the purpose of this proposal, to say, you know, help somebody who's on active duty and let where they're stationed. As I say, if the person goes back to Minnesota, you should be able to revoke it, assuming you're able to get your hands on the paperwork and revoke it. But I think it would simplify the process if we just say if you're on active duty, then, you know, then it's, in effect, if it's not active duty, then it expires.
The bill was premised on them being outside of a station. Never mind. Yeah, okay.
So, Senator Betzel, what do you suggest?
I think, Madam Chair, let me just read the proposal. Is a member of the active duty. I think if we, on page 7.36, if we strike and stationed outside of the Minnesota, and the rest of the line. So effective period expiration. A power of attorney executed under this section is effective only when the principal is a member of the military in active service.
Period.
Well, Senator Betzel, if we go and look at the rest of the bill, I think the whole premise of the bill is that they're outside the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Well, I don't make a motion right now.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess if it's the intent of the committee to want to do something and they're comfortable that we continue to work on this language to make sure that it mirrors the intent of the author, you know, perhaps we could either bring it back later today or we could pass it and just continue to make sure that we look at that language and maybe rework it a little bit.
No, Senator Olson, I think that we'll just add a sentence right here and we'll be done with the bill.
Okay.
I think at line 7.37, before the period, just insert outside of the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you – I walked in after you started talking. Did you have an amendment earlier? I don't know if you dealt with language on page 5, line 15. It's pretty clear what it says this is for. Line 15 and 16 on page 5.
Yes. So it should go with that.
It should match.
Yes, and that's why Senator Betzel said that once he had a chance to look at what the underlying factor in the bill was.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd move that amendment then.
Senator Olson moves that oral amendment that on line 7.37, before the period insert outside of the state of Minnesota. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Anybody else would like to be heard on Senate File 1712? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 1712 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Captain, thank you for making the time to come in. Thank you. Thanks to you and your family. Senator Torres Ray, Senate File 1503. Senator Torres Ray, how many known amendments to you do you know are coming onto this bill?
Only one.
Only one? Mm-hmm. And do you have a copy of the amendment with you?
Yes, I do have the amendment.
Can you name the number so we can get the amendment passed out?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes.
Okay.
It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Torres Ray moves the Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to the bill. This is our second committee? All right. So Senator Scheid moves the A1 amendment, and Senator Torres Ray is going to go through her bill, and then Senator Scheid will explain the A1 amendment. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1503 is a child welfare policy bill that has some technical provisions that will put the state of Minnesota in compliance with federal regulations. And with me, I have Ms. Erin Sullivan Sutton from the Department of Human Services that will go through the language that is relevant to this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I will walk you through the bill. It looks like a large bill because it's many pages. However, it really covers a couple of areas that are consistent with what the legislative direction of Minnesota in the past. The first 36 pages of the bill are purely technical amendments. Normally, you would see these things in a technical bill, but this year the department added them to the policy bill. Article 2, which begins on page 37, begins the substantive portion of the amendments. Article 2 establishes the framework for achieving priorities and setting directions, and the proposed amendments in the bill really fall in four primary large areas. One has to do with expanding the role and responsibility of the tribes participating in the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative. Secondly, there are clarifications in the bill with respect to reasons for removing children from their home to ensure that we're only placing children who are in need of placement due to reasons of protection, access to treatment, or because they are a threat to themselves or others. In this area, there's also provisions regarding enhancing placement prevention and reunification efforts and ensuring that relative and sibling connections are maintained when children need out-of-home care. Third, there are provisions in here to improve efforts to involve more fathers more often in child placement and custody matters. It's very important that we involve fathers in decision-making and case planning when children are in out-of-home care. And then finally, a federal law was passed this past session entitled Fostering Connections to Success, which made a number of amendments to Title 4E, and there are a number of mandatory provisions that we need to put in state law in order to maintain our eligibility for Title 4E. These provisions are consistent with policy direction in Minnesota in the past. However, we're recommending conforming language so that our language in state law is in conformity with the federal law. And with that, I will go through the sections of the bill. Many of the areas are related together, so I will talk about related provisions at the same time. Section 2 of the bill would amend language with respect to the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative. As you may recall, the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe operate their own child welfare.
Ms. Erin Sullivan Sutton, can't you hang in a second? All of Article 1 are technical corrections, right?
That is correct.
Can you just walk us through sort of the pages on the technical corrections, the aspects of it? Instead of just kind of skipping over it, I think we should just
kind
of leaf through them.
Section 1 of the technical section amends the Interstate Compact for the placement of children, and there's a couple of sections related to that, and these are technical changes that were put forth by the American Public Human Services Association to the Interstate Compact. You passed the compact last year, and it will become effective when 35 states have passed. Section 2 is simply a technical amendment to correct a site reference to the definition of domestic child abuse in the juvenile code. Section 3 is a technical amendment to Minnesota Chapter 260, the juvenile code, to reference voluntary placement of a child for purposes of treatment. Sections 4 and 5 are related to background studies and are amended to maintain continuity of the county and commissioner's responsibility throughout this section of statute. Section 6 is a technical amendment to correct site references for fair hearings. Section 7 is a technical amendment to correct the construction of a sentence. And Section 8 is a statement of the revisor's instructions. And Section 9 repeals a section of Minnesota Statute 260C to be consistent with requirements that are currently in the licensing area.
Any questions on Article 1 on all the technical amendments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I just can't resist. Since I had a bill before this committee a few years ago about an interstate compact, and they were not kind to me on the committee. I think Senator Betzel may have been chairing.
What committee?
There are some people in the room who were there. I just want to point out that some of the language having to do with immunity of directors and board members and responsibility, they're pretty boilerplate language to interstate compacts, as I was pointing out then. I just wanted to say, there it is. I'm sorry, I just had to.
Madam Chair?
I couldn't resist. I don't take it personally, though.
No.
Senator Betzel?
Either the passage of time or the change of the authors, one of them might have made a difference.
Well, you know, members, this just goes to show that if you stay around long enough, there's always opportunity for some therapy.
Not here.
Not here.
All right, Article 2.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Ms. Sullivan-Sung, as you get through each section, can you just pause a little bit and let the members kind of catch up? That would be very good. Thank
well,
you.
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Page reference,
if and page page references too. If you don't, we'll have you pause so that we can flip through the pages.
Right.
So Article 2 starts on page 37.
Okay. Section 1 of Article 2 is a federal requirement. And this section would add a provision in the data practices area to allow child support to share data with child welfare for purposes of establishing parentage and locating parents to support permanency for foster children. This is consistent with change in federal law that allows child welfare agencies to access the parent locator service.
That new language, members, is on page 41 of the bill.
Yep.
Please proceed.
The change in Section 2 is on page 43 of the bill, and this language would allow the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, which are conducting their own child welfare services for children living on their reservation. This would allow them to conduct their own children's mental health screenings under the Children's Mental Health Act and would allow them to establish a local child mortality review, and this is in the bill at their request.
Questions? Please proceed.
Section 3 of the bill, new language is on page 44. This section contains an amendment to clarify that the requirement to search the Minnesota Father's Adoption Registry does not apply when the agency is proceeding under the Safe Place for Newborn section.
Questions? Section 4.
Section 4 makes the limitation on asserting an interest in a child when a putative father does not register with the father's adoption registry applicable in both adoption and termination of parental rights proceedings.
Section 5.
Section 5 The new language begins on page 45 and continues for the next couple of pages. This section pertains to amending the reasonable effort standard in social service agencies to make placement and to prevent placement and finalize a permanent plan for the child. The amendment identifies safety plans as an effort to prevent placement, clarifies that reasonable efforts standard to prevent placement does not apply when community services cannot meet a child with disabilities need for treatment, but clarifies that those placements must be determined to be medically necessary. When placement is necessary, this section clarifies that children's relatives are to be contacted and provided notice consistent with the juvenile code and identify efforts to place siblings together or ensure sibling visitation.
Section 6.
Section 6 of the bill begins on page 48. This section aligns the definition of foster care in the delinquency statutes with the definition of foster care in the child protection statutes. Clarifies that foster care must not be used as a punishment or consequence of a child's behavior. This section also amends the considerations of the juvenile treatment screening teams to consider the availability of community services when determining if out-of-home placement is necessary for a child with disabilities to receive needed treatment.
Please proceed.
Sections 8, 9, and 21 are related, and these sections ensure that foster care is intended to provide for a child's safety, the safety of others, or to access treatment. Again, clarifies that foster care must not be used as a punishment or consequence for the child's behavior.
Proceed.
Sections 10 and 11 begin on page 53. These sections clarify the definition of parent and add provisions to the statute to ensure diligent efforts to identify, locate, and notify both parents of a child. This includes the use of genetic testing and lists diligent efforts the agency must make to find parents and defines court procedures to review those efforts. Also, this section specifies that the efforts do not apply to safe place for newborn situations.
And Ms. Erin Sullivan Sutton, where did this, what brought about this new change or addition in language?
This is part of the federal requirement under the fostering connections.
Good. Please proceed.
Sections 12, 13, 14, and 15 are related and begin on page 55 and go to 57. These sections provide procedures to issue a notice or summons when filing a petition of termination of parental rights. It ensures that a summons is issued to a parent and a notice is issued to a grandparent with the right to participate. It defines written notice as provided in the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection so that the statute is consistent with the court rules and make clear that it is not a requirement to notify a putative father who has not registered with the father's adoption registry.
Questions? Please proceed.
Sections 16 and 30 are related. These sections provide specific authority for the juvenile court to use alternative dispute processes to resolve child welfare matters as appropriate and as maybe in the best interest of the child.
And where did this come from?
This comes from the work of many counties and court districts who are part of the Children's Justice Initiative and have been working over a course of a number of years to identify alternatives to having to have trials in child protection matters where issues could be resolved short of trial.
I think Senator Foley would appreciate this. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Section 17 and 18. Concern police officers taking a child into immediate custody under 72-hour hold, and when a child runs away from a parent or guardian, the statute is amended to order that a police officer may transport a child home to a relative or another safe place and eliminates running away as a sole reason for taking a child into custody. The statute is amended to allow social service agencies the authority to release a child from custody after an assessment and implementation of a safety plan for the child.
Please proceed.
Section 19 is related to that and is amended to remove running away as a reason to maintain a child in custody and adds reasonable effort standards to place siblings together and develop a plan for sibling visitation if placement of siblings together is not possible. And the sibling section is part of the Fostering Connections Act. And I should note Minnesota does a fairly good job of keeping siblings together.
Please proceed.
Section 20 and 22 are related. These sections ensure that the reasonable social service agency has a duty to develop and implement a plan for parent visitation and contact unless the court finds that visitation would endanger the child. It sets uniform procedures to address visitation for a parent who has had no or limited contact with a child and allows parentage to be established for a putative father before visitation begins if that is in the child's best interest.
And Ms. Sullivan Sutton, on line 62.8, there's a cross-reference to statute 260C, subdivision 5 and 260C, 175 subdivision 1. Can you just remind us what that is? If a child has been taken into custody under those circumstances.
Madam Chair, could you repeat the line number, please?
62.8. Under the parental visitation?
Though, Madam Chair, I believe those sections refer to situations when a child is removed on an emergency basis or 72-hour hold.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Please proceed.
Section 21 specifies that if court finds that a child is in need of protection or services because the child is a runaway or habitual truant, the child may not be placed in foster care as punishment. Again, children should be placed in care for protection or if they are in need of treatment or a danger to themselves or others.
Please proceed.
Section 23 is related to the federal requirement under fostering connections but is not inconsistent with Minnesota practice. This section amends the required content of an out-of-home placement plan to require specific efforts to ensure that the foster child's health care needs are met, and a plan is there to ensure educational stability and how the child's health, mental health, and dental records are going to be maintained.
And Ms. Sullivan Sutton, in this section, is it practicable for this to happen, for them to evaluate that in terms of health care plans?
Madam Chair, members, currently county agency workers have responsibility for addressing children's educational and physical and mental health needs, so this is not inconsistent with that.
Very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
Section 24 is, again, related to the federal requirements and applies the reasonable effort standard to place siblings together in foster care and requires the agency to provide visits if the siblings cannot be placed together. When joint placement of siblings would be contrary to the safety or well-being of any sibling, it requires documentation, and this would be consistent with current Minnesota practice.
Please proceed.
Section 25, again, is a federal requirement, and it requires that monthly caseworker visits include determinations of whether the child is enrolled and attending school and addressing the issues through case planning and service delivery if the child is not in school.
And are we able to meet this requirement under current law
today? Madam Chair, I believe so. Workers do attend to educational issues when kids are in out-of-home placement.
So without adding this additional requirement, we are able to make the monthly caseworker visits?
Madam Chair, that's a good question because that's a different question. We have a responsibility under federal law to meet federal state performance standards for monthly casework visits, and you passed legislation to clarify that last session. We are currently not meeting federal standards, but we are improving. What this provision says is when you are out there doing the visits, you need to pay attention to the educational issues.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, don't we have federal dollars that are attached to our ability to meet this requirement?
Madam Chair, members, yes, there are. We have until, I believe, 2011 to meet the federal standards for conducting monthly visits, and we do not. If we do not meet the standards, we will face fiscal penalties.
And I know that this is not in this section of the bill, but this is an area that interests me a lot. So do we have a plan to put us on the way to meeting that target sooner rather than later?
Madam Chair, members, yes, we do. We are consistently monitoring the frequency of visits that are entered into the social service information system. We have identified targets in the interim and are continuing to provide that data and report to the counties as well as the federal government.
And under the current budget difficulties that we're experiencing, are you anticipating, are you seeing anything under either the governor's proposal or the Senate of the House proposals that's going to inhibit or prohibit us from attaining that goal?
Madam Chair, members, excellent question. Because child welfare is so heavily reliant on property tax dollars in Minnesota, as well as some state money through the Child and Community Services Act and federal money, the availability of resources for counties to do the child protection work is an area of concern that we need to continue to monitor. I've got an email this week from one of our counties in southeast Minnesota who is very concerned because they are not able to fill positions as vacancies occur, and she's writing to put us on notice that they might not be able to meet this requirement. So it's an issue that we all need to closely monitor.
Well, Ms. Erin Sullivan-Sutton, this committee has a great interest in the welfare of our children. Even though we're the Judiciary Committee, we know that when the system doesn't adequately serve the needs of our children, they somehow have to come through the judicial system in some way. And I think we're all concerned about this particular area. We would like to be helpful with putting additional requirements on those who do actually make the visits. But adding requirements to the visit doesn't do much if the visits aren't being performed.
Madam Chair, members, I appreciate that, and the department and the county child welfare agencies have appreciated the interest and concern that this committee has consistently shown for this area of practice over the years. This is an area that we do need to stay on top of. It was our hope that in the governor's proposal with respect to protecting children, where we would have in statute the legislature's interest in this area, as well as a provision to really have a quality assurance system in place so that the data was consistently available in terms of whether or not we're meeting standards and able to do the job that we're charged with doing in the child protection system, would have gone somewhere this session. I think we will continue to be talking about that into the future.
Thank you. Section 26?
Section 26 is, again, a federal requirement, and this pertains to the relative's search requiring due diligence to identify and notify adult relatives prior to placement or within 30 days after the child is removed from the parent's care, and amends the notice requirement by adding that the relative may participate in the care and planning for the child and includes specific information about the family foster care licensing requirements and how a relative may request a variance from licensing standards that do not present a safety risk to the child. Again, this is consistent with current practice. The federal language uses the term diligence, and we're trying to conform our language to meet the federal.
Next section.
Section 27 is a federal requirement, and this section pertains to foster children age 17 or older who are aging out of foster care. There is now a requirement, this would have a requirement for the agency to develop a transition plan during the 90 days immediately prior to the child's discharge. The plan would specify options for the child regarding housing, health insurance, education, employment services, and support services. Under current law, counties, when there's a child in out-of-home placement, they are to develop a transitional living plan with the child after they reach the age of 16. So this is consistent with that policy, but would make sure that there are the details in place within 90 days of the child's exiting foster care.
And Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, this plan is given to whom once it's developed? Who reviews this plan?
This plan would be reviewed by the child, and there's also a requirement that the juvenile court judge review what is happening. And last year, the Minnesota legislature passed language that would require the juvenile court judge to make specific findings in each of the main areas of the child's life so that there is an independent review that the agency is, in fact, helping that child prepare for transition. So there's findings related to job, employment, school, et cetera, health care.
So, Ms. Ernst-Solvenson, how many of these do we do on an average a year that would be submitted to the juvenile court judge for review?
Madam Chair, members, I don't have that number on the top of my head, but there's on average about 500 kids who age out of the foster care system every year. These kids are currently before the court before they age out. And again, this would increase the focus on the last 90 days.
So, Senator Foley, if the courts doesn't have any funding, I don't think we'd be able to continue to do some of this work. Please continue.
Sections 28 and 29 are related to children in voluntary foster care for treatment, and it clarifies that the treatment is to be determined to be medically necessary.
And section 29?
Yes, 28 and 29.
Medical necessary. So
that is the conclusion of the child welfare provisions.
Here's your question.
Any questions for the witness or for Senator Torres-Ray?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheib.
Chair, if I might, on page 75, I just happened to be reading through about children in foster care past age 18, and I just asked Senator Betzold if we still register for the selective service on line 33 of that page. I thought maybe we could. I should stop reading. I don't think we do that anymore. I mean, I realize it probably doesn't matter. They just say, well, they don't do that anymore. But
Senator Scheib, I think it's mandatory. You still have to register for the selective services.
We don't have a draft.
We don't have a draft. You continue to register so they have you in the system, but the president gets to declare a draft with the people who are in the system.
Okay. Do people know that they still must register?
Well, Senator Scheib, that's the problem, and what we're finding is that a lot of young men who don't register are actually not able to apply for federal financial aid for colleges. Okay. So several years ago, I did a bill to make it automatic when you go get your driver's license, if you're young and male, that you automatically, when you renew, when you go from your transitional license to your adult driver's license, that you have to automatically register so that it will help some of our young people who are not registering because they don't know about it and not miss an opportunity to qualify for federal financial aid and scholarships. Senator Scheib?
That problem is probably exacerbated by people like me thinking that they no longer have to do it.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Limmer?
Do we require young women to register?
No, very good point.
No, Senator Limmer.
Should we do an amendment?
You know, Senator Limmer, I did appreciate your exception to Senator Anderson's bill the other day about not having the posters in the male bathrooms. I thought you were being pretty consistent on the committee.
It's the feminist side in
me,
Madam Chair. It's coming out.
Any questions to Senator Torres-Ray on Senate File 1503? Senator Scheib, I believe you have an amendment.
Madam Chair.
The A1 amendment.
Yes.
Business.
And Madam Chair, this, I think, was heard in the committee and passed. It's from language from a bill. I think it's the exact language that the committee heard regarding an adopted person's ability to obtain medical or social history information from a birth parent. It goes to, and I don't know if Senator Rest wants to explain it. I've read it pretty carefully, and it tells how Section 6, which is on page 1, parent C, line 28, talks about how they request the original birth record information, and it says if the birth parent doesn't want to, they have 90 days to let the Commissioner of Health know that that shouldn't be disclosed, and if they ask for medical or social history, and I think we understand how important that is and can be to individuals and has been lacking in many people's lives, this is really important. So this tells how the child placing agency then has to notify that birth parent that they must complete the non-identifying form. This is if they don't want their information disclosed from the birth record. Then there's further language on if the birth parent files an affidavit objecting to release, then it gives a time frame for how they go about getting the information. At the very end of, section 8 of the bill on page 3, then it changes the time frame from 31 days to 91 days where the Commissioner of Health would disclose the information requested by the adopted person. And then there is apparently, and I've forgotten this from the conversation of Senator Rest, but the language at the bottom of page 3, line 31, where the person was adopted before August 1st of 1977. So that person would be 32 years old or more at this point, in August.
Right.
So 31 years old and older. I don't know. I've done a very complete job, but that is what the...
So members, Senator Scheid has put the what the bill does before us. We've passed this bill twice in this committee. It came to us, we passed it, it went to the floor. Some of the advocates had concerns about it. Senator Rest generously referred it back to our committee. We did more work on it. And then we passed it out of the committee. It went to the floor. The pre-77 language is Senator Limmer's amendment to the bill, and the bill actually was considered and has passed the Senate floor, Senator Rest. And so we thought that given all the crazy things that happen that takes place around here, that because this committee has given so much consideration to it and given that it's germane to this bill because of the adoption provisions in here, we wanted to help Senator Ress and former Representative Tingelstad out by putting this language into this bill. So we're not trying to sneak this by anybody. It's not an issue of not giving anybody due notice. We just wanted to make sure that this language, it's in a number of places. So on the A1 amendment. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussions? Incentive House 1503.
Chair?
Senator Limmer.
Could Senator Torres-Ray, could you explain the repealer regarding background checks?
The background check repealer?
Is that in the, excuse me.
The last page of the bill.
Ms. Pontius. Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative Limmer, this section simply provides that when a local agency is doing a local check regarding health and safety, they don't have to send all of the information to the state. They will continue to send information to the state for purposes of foster care licenses and that sort of thing. But where they're placed on an emergency basis and they want, and this is consistent with current provisions in the licensing statute, it just simply continues to allow them to do a local check.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
When I read the repealer regarding background checks, this is what you're repealing. The commissioner must provide the subject of the background study. I'm assuming that's the individual with the results of the study as required. And I don't know if your answer satisfied what's written here on the repealer.
Technical.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I'm Ann Alstrom. I'm with the Children's Justice Initiative in the State Court Administrator's Office, but I'm here speaking on behalf of the Department of Human Services. At this point in the process, there is no background study. The point where this kind of a background check is done in the field by social services who's feeling they have to remove a child. They want to do what I would term an initial screening for safety for that child, so they ask for assistance. Is there anything in criminal history or in child protection or in adult protection that indicates this would not be a safe place for the child? If there's a positive hit, it's likely that the agency isn't going to make that placement. If there isn't a hit, in other words, if the background check is negative, then they are likely going to put that child with that relative and then proceed to licensing. So there's no, the terminology would not be background study at that point in time. It really is a preliminary screening in the field. So that's why there's no requirement to provide the information to the individual.
Okay. Senator Limmer. Is the subject that's referred to, is that an individual?
Ms. Alston?
Or who is the subject in this
I'm
case?
I'm sorry, I missed the page number, Madam Chair.
It's on the last
R.
page.
Madam Chair, the subject of the background chair check would be the individual who is being checked. So it would be the relative who is being checked. Do you have anything in your background?
Ms. Alstrom, who would the caseworker would be making this inquiry of whom about the subject?
Madam Chair, generally the mechanics of it would be they contact local law enforcement on criminal background history, and or they may have a terminal that's accessible in the county attorney's office. It's available for this purpose. And then obviously on their own records, social services records, they have their own computer terminals that are available. So the mechanics of it would be ask local law enforcement, use county attorney terminal if that's available, and use their own computer terminal for social services information.
So Ms. Alstrom, mechanically, do they get the permission, or is there some kind of a warning or consent form that the subject signs off for this preliminary inquiry to take place?
Madam Chair, the provision generally 260C-209 actually grants the local agency that permission without prior authorization. You have a social worker who's in the field dealing with an emergency and trying to sort out who are the possible relatives this child could go be with right now. So rather than driving to the individual's home and executing a consent, 260C-209 gives the agency permission to access that information. So there is no consent that's given.
So, Ms. Alstrom, in the instance where the subject does get the check, it does come back that, let's say, Uncle John has a couple of convictions on the record, thereby Uncle John can't have Jimmy. Does Uncle John get told why Jimmy is not placed with Uncle John?
Madam Chair, at this point in the process, probably not. Maybe. I mean, it depends on if they're actually talking to the uncle about whether or not placement is a possibility. More likely what's going to happen is if the placement continues and uncle is interested, then the agency would be discussing with him under other provisions that are in the bill. You have the possibility of having this child in your home, and at that point in time, he could proceed to ask to be licensed, and at that point in time would be told what the problem is, and at that point in time would be referred to the commissioner. If there's incorrect information, there would be the opportunity to correct it.
So if Uncle John is Jimmy's only living relative in an emergency, and Uncle John is found preliminarily to be ineligible, then Jimmy will be placed in an emergency shelter or an emergency-type place?
Yes, that is what would happen.
Senator Betzel.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Alstrom, let me just clarify. The language to be repealed refers to a study as required under Chapter 245C. So are you saying that there is no study being required under Chapter 245C or screening, or what is it?
Madam Chairman.
Ms. Alstrom.
Senator Betzel, that is an accurate statement of the law. At this point in time, there is no study that's done. That study is done in connection with developing the placement for licensing.
Okay. Any further questions on Senate File 1503 as amended? I know there's an individual here who would like to testify on this bill. Is that person still here? Come on up to the, is it Ms. Frohley?
Fraley.
Ms. Fraley, please identify yourself and your organization for the record.
My name is Melissa Fraley. I'm with the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network. We're a statewide nonprofit organization that works to increase healthy father involvement. And we do that primarily in two ways. We work with professionals who work with fathers and families, including child protection professionals, to increase their ability to engage fathers, as well as working with policymakers to improve public policy. I believe I'm listed here as a con, although actually 90-plus percent of this bill is very father-friendly, and we're very much in support of the changes that are being made that are in regards to non-resident parents most of the time who are fathers. My background before coming to the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network was as an attorney representing fathers, and I did do some CHIPS cases representing low-income non-custodial fathers, so I have experience in this area. We have a couple of concerns that we have talked to the department about and that we are talking to the Children's Justice Initiative about that I believe we're going to be able to resolve, but they really go to making sure that non-resident parents, again, most of the time who are fathers, have the opportunity to have notice and to be heard when decisions are made. So, for example, there are some changes made to visitation that were referred to earlier. When a parent has no or limited contact with visitation, the court could, or actually under the current language, shall deny visitation at that point until an assessment can be done of that parent. We're concerned that there is opportunity for the non-resident parent in that situation to be heard about those concerns later on in the process. There's another concern with the way this law interacts with the Minnesota Fathers Adoption Registry and some language that's been added as to terminating parental rights. We want to make sure that if they're looking for a relative and there's a father who's registered with the Minnesota Fathers Adoption Registry, that father gets due consideration, even if it's late registration, as long as it's during the CHIPS process and not during the termination process. So we do have a couple of concerns, but we have been talking to the department today and to the Children's Justice Initiative, and I believe that we will be able to resolve those concerns.
So if members of the committee are all right, I sense that they just need to tweak the language.
Yes.
And I don't think we have to do that today, but I think in policy, I think committee members are supportive of the direction that you're going in. So you'll continue to work with the department and with Senator Torres-Ray, and if anything is extraordinarily out of whack, we'll have some input, but I think we'll be, in general, supportive of the direction. Any further discussions in Senate File 1503? Senator Limmer?
Would any of these suggestions be in the form of an amendment before the floor session? Is that what you're intending, or is it something over a greater period of time that you'd come and revisit it perhaps in a year?
Senator Torres-Ray?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't know yet. I know that we have been working on trying to put some amendments and we were trying to get ready for this committee, but we need to talk to the department about it, so I don't know.
Madam Chair, if you have amendments, could you make sure that we know about them before the Senate floor discussion and make sure we know that it's coming out of this conversation?
Senator Torres-Ray, I think that would be helpful.
All right.
And Senator Limmer is the lead Republican on the committee, and I think it would be helpful to have his assistance, knowing that that's the direction we want to move in.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, absolutely. Yeah, we were just not ready to put the language. I think the department wants to work on it a little bit more, but we'll let you know.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right. So seeing that there's no further discussion, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 1503, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Just taking a break.
Senator Rust.
We could reconsider her.
Senate File 747.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And once again, thank you for the courtesy of keeping a bill. I promise you that bill won't come back again.
Oh, sure.
Third time visiting this committee.
Well, yeah. We're doing that to ensure that it doesn't come back.
Something.
Third time's the charm.
The Senate File 747 deals with non-conforming lots in shoreland areas, and the bill has been before state and local government and also the Environment Committee. It represents a lot of work over the past couple of years. We've heard in a number of sessions how difficult some of the current law is with regard to knowing just what's possible on a piece of shoreland property that is non-conforming in one way or the other. And the bill, as before you, represents a coming together of the special interests that care about these issues, and represents the engrossment that you have, represents the compromises that have been made between local governments, DNR, and those who are interested in protecting property rights. If you would, I'm not sure of which sections are the ones that are the jurisdiction of this committee. I do have, I think you do have some, did you pass information? I think the page passed some information out from the DNR that represents the agreements that have been made on, that reached on this bill. And he is here to answer any questions on it. On, and if you, I don't, again, I don't know exactly which sections are of interest to this committee, Madam Chair.
Senator, Ms. Pontius and I were just talking about that, and I think that pretty much a little piece of every section is in the committee because we're talking about real estate and conforming records, and so I wondered if your witness, if you or your witness could maybe take us through the bill.
Yeah. The first section clarifies that the damage, that when there's damage to non-conforming property, that it's measured by the estimated market value as indicated in the records of the county assessor at the time of damage. And it provides that if the if it is a non, if there's a non-conforming structure on that piece of land and there is less than and that structure was less than 50% of the required setback from the water, in rebuilding it after it is damaged, the setback has to be increased if it is practicable. And that is, that was the really operative word in the bill. Not possible, and was or the word possible was rejected as too high a standard, and but practicable was acceptable as a standard rather than it just had to be moved. I mean, it was, it is really a midpoint, but it's still a pretty high standard, I think. But it allows there to be some negotiation on whether or not you really can move the setback, move the damaged structure back. And before this, you could only rebuild on the footprint of the structure that was there, and you couldn't make any additions or anything like that. So this is a this is a, I think, a very good compromise agreed to by, again, the interests that have been working on this. And the second paragraph, or second section two, the shoreland lots, again, these non-conforming lots, first of all, the county is required to regulate their use, but it does, it permits a building on a single non-conforming lot without a variance from lot size requirements if certain conditions are met, and the major condition is that whatever you're doing is going, the water is going to be protected. Paragraph C permits an individual non-conforming lot that's part of a group of two or more contiguous non-conforming lots under common ownership to be treated as a separate parcel for the purpose of sale or development, again, if certain conditions are met and the standard is protection of the water. That was not allowed previously, and a lot of landowners or property owners were very disappointed in their lack of opportunity to do that. D requires a non-conforming lot that doesn't meet the conditions to be combined with one or more contiguous lots so that they equal a conforming lot. So there's another way of combining the properties to get them in line. Paragraph E allows contiguous non-conforming lots that have a common ownership to be sold or purchased individually if the lots had a livable structure on them at the time that the lots came under that common ownership. And additionally, in terms of the environmental concern, that they had adequate sewage treatment. So it's two lots, two houses, and and common ownership that they could be sold or purchased individually. Paragraph F requires the property owner to deal with conservation and water protection measures as a part of the request for the variance. And the final paragraph clarifies that a portion of a conforming lot, well, this is a conforming lot, not a non-conforming lot, can be separated from an existing parcel as long as the remainder continues to be conforming and the newly created parcel is then combined with an adjacent parcel. The DNR and going out of our committee last year invited people to send in examples of how they were being restricted from doing things on their property that they thought were reasonable and that ought to be allowed, but that current law got in the way. And as I understand it, there were like 10 and 10 instances that were put forward, and this language solves 9 of them, and which is, you know, another indication that no bill is perfect, but the 10th situation, and I'm not even sure what it was, you just can't solve every single problem. But this solved, again, 90% of the complaints about from all sides, concern from the water, the jurisdiction of local governments in granting variances and permits, and what we recognized as legitimate issues of property owners and wanting to be able to have control over their property. That's the bill, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
Mr. Mueller is here from the DNR to Mr. Lacosmo wasn't able to be here. Mr. Mueller is here, and he can answer any questions from the DNR's perspective.
Thank you for making the time to be here. Well, we'll see if the members have questions, and they can ask questions. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Reston. As I'm sure you can imagine, a lot of those letters that the DNR received were also letters that came to me because a lot of them came from my district. I'm just wondering whether the proposals in this bill are compatible with what's going on with the rulemaking process right now that the DNR is looking at with shoreline rulemaking, and if they're consistent with what's being developed there with the past alternative shoreline rules, more liberal, less liberal, or consistent kind of.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, lastly, Mr. Mueller can respond to your question. It's a very good one because
Mr. Mueller,
we've been dealing with that.
Madam
too.
Chair, Senator, my name is Mike Mueller, and I'm the Shoreland Program Coordinator for the Division of Waters, DNR. The ongoing shoreland revision process is resulting in some draft rules. The parts dealing with nonconformities is being sort of deferred pending the results of this bill, because we know that it is going to supersede shoreland rules. These what you have before you is slightly different than the alternative shoreland standards that you referenced, which are not mandatory. They were developed in several years ago in the five-county north central area. They use a standard of 75% of the shoreland lot size as a standard for determining when a non-conforming contiguous lot can be separated and sold from the adjoining one. This standard is 66%. The reason for that is because during the review process of the examples that were submitted, we determined that there were a number of cases where on a recreational development lake, where the minimum lot width is 150 feet, there were in fact non-conforming lots that were 100 feet wide and in other respects were buildable, had adequate area for septic systems, but because they were only 100 feet wide, they were non-conforming and couldn't be sold separately. So the 66% standard allows for that type of a transaction to occur on recreational development shoreland classifications.
Senator Olson?
So, Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Mueller. So you're not saying they could sell a 100-foot lot and then build a house if the lake requires a 150-foot lot. You're just saying that if there were two buildings on each one, they could separate them. And if there were already existing buildings there, they could separate them and sell them?
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair, Senator, if it is a single nonconforming lot and they can meet setbacks and they can put on a soil treatment sewage system or hook up to public sewer, they can sell it, buy it, develop it. If there are contiguous lots that are nonconforming, then the standard would be 66% of the lot size. So in the case that you cited, yes, they would be able to separate a 100-foot lot from the adjoining lot, and provided that they can meet setbacks from the lake and they can provide a sewage treatment system.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest. Oh, sorry, Senator Parasol.
Madam Chair, I looked at this and I saw on line 121, first page, the board may impose. And I wanted to say, what board? I thought, well, is that the county board? Is it the township board? Is it a city council, which could be a board? Or what kind of board?
Senator Rest.
In my district, we are having a war right now on the between the watershed trying to impose things on all the townships. And that board is very suspect right now, more than suspect. It's a
Madam Chair,
to a lot of
the third section
derision
of the bill indicates that it is for cities and towns. So it's the same as sections 1 and 2.
And there are very severe penalties for dividing your land without having, and they also insist upon 150-foot buffers. I mean, buffers have to be 150 feet, right, which is more than they ever insisted upon in the past.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, Senator Parasot, this bill addresses that issue.
Yes.
Well, as in a reasonable way.
Maybe we need some more meetings in my district, and you can come and speak there.
All right. And I'll be talking about the shell game of nonconforming lots.
Senator Rest, as it relates to shorelined property, yes, or all properties?
All properties.
Senator Rest?
All properties.
These provisions are for shoreland lots.
For shoreline lots.
This is shoreline, yes. Purposes.
Senator Parasol has a concern that is could potentially be a little bit larger than just shoreline lots, but... But
because everybody in the watershed is subject to it, regardless of whether you're on the river or not. But if you're in the river's watershed, you're subject to it.
I need to answer that.
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair, Senator Parasol, I do believe that because this is the county legislation in the first part, that it does refer to a county board that can impose conditions, and it would not be specific to shoreland in this particular line.
Good. Okay.
Thank you. But in our county, the county commissioners are the people who sit on the watershed board.
Yeah,
scattered throughout the shed.
She was reading up here.
here.
Madam Chair, I have a question about, I understand, I think I know what impervious surfaces are, and I'm just wondering, would that include a roof here? I mean, to me, that's an impervious surface. I think it is. So it couldn't exceed 25% of the lot. Is that what you say? Then, therefore, the structure itself really couldn't either, could it?
No. Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, where are you looking?
Well, I see it in several places, but on page 2, line 18, and then it is also on page 4, I believe, on line 19. I was just curious.
Madam Chair, I know the answer to that.
Senator Olson knows the answer to that, Senator Scheid.
I mean, it includes the building itself.
And the
so
roof.
The roof.
It includes
and
roofs.
It includes, like, if you have a black top on your driveway or, you know, anything
concrete
that wouldn't be able to absorb groundwater.
Ah, so.
Here's what she's talking about.
I'm just curious, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
I might ask Mr. Mueller, thank you, Madam Chair, if you have a cabin and it's raised up and so there's air underneath. Well, I mean, it is. Can I say? Is that still considered impervious? Because water certainly can drain there.
Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe no. The definition of impervious is that water can't penetrate into it. Okay. So if there is soil beneath the structure because it's elevated,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
You know, Senator Rest, I come from a country where I was born in a country where 80% of the homes were on stilts. I understand that.
Yeah.
I used to vacation on Albert Banks where the same thing was true.
That's right.
Any further discussions in Senate File 747? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, again, I just have the question I have is maybe a broad question, but if and I certainly sympathize with some of the situations that are addressed in your bill. Like, I've heard complaints from people who buy two lots that are nonconforming, but then they can't resell them again because they happen to be a common owner, and you know, that kind of problem arises. But I wonder if I'm reading this, maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but it almost makes it sound like we have these standards for how large a lot is supposed to be for lakes. And aren't we sort of then preempting that standard that's set and saying you don't really have to follow the lot size then? You really only need to have 66% of the lot size? I mean, are we reducing across the board lot sizes for lakes that are presently in law?
Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that the problem is that when you have nonconformities, if there's no rational way to eliminate or lessen the nonconformity, then they prevail and they continue in their existence. And so what we were trying to do was come up with a compromise that allows local units the opportunity to look at issues that may impact water quality, such as stormwater runoff or proximity to the lake or lack of vegetation and those kinds of practices, and use those to offset the fact that nonconforming lots are out there by the thousands, and if we can't deal with the impacts that they create, then we're never going to get ahead in the fight to improve water quality. So obviously new lots have a higher standard, and that's as it should be and as it has been with shoreland management for 35 years.
Senator Olson, follow up?
Madam Chair, sorry, but just one final question because I know how important this is to a lot of people I've heard from. So the Environmental Committee, I'm assuming, has already looked at this and passed this through.
And the State and Local Government Committee. We're the last stop, Senator Olson. No further discussions. Senator Olson, you want to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 747 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Anybody who would like to be heard in Senate File 747? Seeing none, on Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Dahl.
Senate File 806. Welcome back to the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, members. It's good to always good to be back. I do have Senate File 806, and I do have an A6 amendment that will put the bill into a few technical things, put it in proper order.
It's not its first stop, so it's not an author's amendment. We'll hear about it as Senator Dahl goes through the bill.
Madam Chair, let me just give you a little background on where this bill has been. Once upon a time, there was a great big bad payday lending bill. There was one introduced last year that Payday America and others said would put them out of business. That failed. This particular bill I introduced at the beginning of this session is a result of a lot of work from people, the university and elsewhere that had some real concerns about where payday lending has gone and where it might go. That particular bill early in the session would have limited the number of loans that a person might have. That is no longer in this bill. What we have is a result of Mr. Elwood and many others working in conjunction with lenders like Payday America and Unloan and others that this is what we can agree to. And so I want to commend all the parties that have come to bring this bill where it's at. It has gone through Commerce. We had the long discussion, and more recently a short discussion because, again, we believe that all the concerns have been addressed in this bill. What the bill does, very briefly, and Mr. Elwood can elaborate, would apply debt collection protections to collection of payday loans. It would require written contracts, make unequivocal that Minnesota has jurisdiction over internet payday lenders, and also adds a few more reporting requirements. Again, as far as we know, there is no opposition. And again, if you want more details, Ron Elwood would be glad to go over those with you.
Mr. Elwood, are you going to walk us through the bill a little bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, yes. And first, I would really like to thank Senator Dahl and Senator Scheid for bringing the parties together to make at least some progress on this issue this session. Section 1 simply let me preface this by saying that there are payday lenders lend under two separate statutes in Minnesota now, Section 4760, which is the Consumer Small Loan Act, and Section 4759, which is the authority that Chapter 53 lenders will use. So there are two different categories of payday lenders. So Section 1 deals with the 4760 lenders, and it's simply requires them to do the reporting that is found in later in the report, later in the bill, section, it's subdivision 5 on Section 4, starting line 4.6. So that makes them do those reports. Section 2, also dealing with Section 4760, makes a violation of the 4760 requirements a violation of the Consumer Fraud Act. Section 3 is where the guts of the bill really starts, and this creates a new section of law that addresses both 4760 and 4759 lenders, and it creates a new term for payday loans called consumer short-term loan. And it subdivision 2, starting on line page 3, line 14, would provides the requirements of a contract, what must be in the contract, and also provisions that may not be in the contract. And that is where the amendment, the A6 amendment, does come in. It puts some limitations on the limitation, if you will. Subdivision 3, starting on page 4, line 1, applies Minnesota's debt collection statutes to collections made by payday lenders. Subdivision 4 is part of the amendment. It has been deleted. Subdivision 5 is the reporting, which gives some additional data that we do not collect now, primarily the number and the nature of the repeat lending in Minnesota. Subdivision 6, page 4, line 23, a very critical provision. It makes it unequivocally clear that Minnesota has jurisdiction over internet lenders and that internet lenders lending to Minnesotans physically located here are subject to Minnesota's laws. And subdivision 7, starting on page 4, line 27, provides for a private right of action for violations of the previous sections. And subdivision 8 makes it clear that the Attorney General also has enforcement powers, as well, of course, as the Department of Commerce. And the final section, section 4, is the same, makes applicable to the 53 lenders or those lending under 4759, makes them do the reporting as well. And that's the bill.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, and I just want to understand. Other than regulating the practice, does it change anything in payday lending under this bill?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I would say that it changes it. It doesn't change the actual nature of the transaction, if that's what you're asking me. No, it does not.
Okay, so Madam Chair, pretty much what goes on today will still go on if this bill becomes law, except they have to register and there's certain information they have to provide to the consumers. That's what the bill does? I'm trying to understand what the bill does.
Ms. Elwood?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, yes, that's right. I mean, the three key things are that there are it extends the jurisdiction of the state over internet lending, which is probably the most important thing. The second thing it does is extend the requirements and prohibitions around debt collection practices to first-party payday lender collectors, because they're now only applicable to third-party collectors. So if Payday America, for example, sells its debt to ABC Collection Agency, they have to comply with Minnesota law. But if Payday America itself collects its own debt, it does not. So now that would make Payday America follow the same rules as ABC Collection Agency. And the reporting is the other piece of it, which is really important because one of the things that we do not know is, and one of the problems of payday lending is people getting into this debt trap and taking loan after loan after loan after loan after loan. But Minnesota, unlike many other states, does not currently collect data on how many loans people take each year and how many take 5, how many take 10. And that would really help us in the future to determine future regulatory suggestions.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer and then Senator Shy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Elwood or Senator, you kind of explained what the cure was, but I still, maybe I missed it, but what are we trying to solve here?
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I think two things that are of primary importance. First of all, we have Minnesota payday lenders domiciled here, storefront, physical locations, people walk in, get loans. We have a whole host of lenders who are operating over the internet who are not today, arguably not today, subject to Minnesota's laws. This makes clear, if it wasn't before, that they are subject. So that's a key problem we're solving. The second problem, I think we're solving, it's not so much perhaps a problem, but the issue of gathering information about the nature of the lending, it's been a discussion that we've been having for years about the repeat serial borrowing, which is what we believe to be a serious, serious problem that we need to do something about, and now we're going to have data to show that either it is or it isn't as of great magnitude as we think it is.
Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer?
In the amendment, or I'm sorry, in the bill, on page 3, line 21, the provision limiting class actions, and then the new language extends that against a consumer short-term lender for violations. How would one limit class actions without being more prescriptive in this writing. How do you limit it without putting limitations in?
Says you can't.
You cannot limit? Is that
what it says?
Madam Chair, the language is, it says no contract. It's put in, phrased in the negative. Okay.
I see it. Okay. All right.
Senator Scheid and then Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl has worked so hard on this, Mr. Elwood has, and it's been more than this just this year. And we've had conversations. We had an interim meeting. I don't know if it was last summer. I think it was the summer before. It was last summer. It seems so long ago. Where we talked with stakeholders, consumers were represented, and the people who do payday loans were there. And they don't all do business the same way. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that's made this tricky. So this is really important, I think, to get a handle on how, I think you call it churning, when people keep taking out a loan because it can't pay off the loan they did 2 weeks ago, or in how much of this is happening. So that's why that reporting is really important. Plus, I really like the internet feature because that's just kind of out of control. And so if we say you're going to conform to Minnesota law, if the person taking out the loan is in Minnesota, then hopefully we win that. But the original bill this year had more requirements, rather stringent requirements about fees and interest rate and annualized interest rate, and I think that some of the people who are in the business of making payday loans were very concerned about, their being able to continue doing that kind of business. And I'm concerned about it to their ability to do it because banks just don't do small unsecured loans to people. I mean, if you have a checking account and you have overdraft protection or whatever those accounts are, I guess I've done that over the course of my life, but a lot of people just don't have that, and they may need to get the car repaired so they can go to work. So then one of the things they have to pay, among their other bills, is this loan, and we care about the terms and conditions of those loans, and this is a really good first step. And I don't think it's going to end here. I think once we start getting the reports, we're going to know more, but I think it's a really important first step, and that's why I encouraged Senator Dahl he encouraged me first, and then I encouraged him, to bring back the bill and get something going this year.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I hope that we might be able to deconstruct Section 2, Subdivision 6, and look at what's happening in there. There are several issues that I'd like to raise about that section. Page 2, lines 18 through 24. I'm wondering why we need to penalize the employees of these companies for violations. That would be certainly different. And directors, I'm not sure why we have to change from a person to, which already includes individuals plus businesses. I think that's broad enough for me without the further explanation and expansion of liability here to directors and employees. I would think a person should be sufficient, but maybe Mr. Elwood or Senator Dahl has a view of that. But I'd like to see us take out everything after, like, reinstate a person and take out everything all the way through employees and then change it to who violates or participates in. That would be the first concern I had with that section.
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, the reason that was changed is because person is not defined in Section 4760. So unlike most other sections of law where a person includes an individual, a firm, et cetera, it's not defined. So that was the reason for the first change. To your second issue, as you will note, the officers, directors, et cetera, that's existing law.
Well, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Sorry, we were just in a different committee in this room. Madam Chair, I think that we could refer back to our other definitions of a person, and then this would be consistent with everything else we've done, which we, in this committee, we've said That's that true. A person refers to individuals and business enterprises. I don't feel comfortable extending it to the employees who may be unwitting employees in a company who need a job, and now we are going to go and collect the triple damages against those employees. I mean, I think we're creating more of a mess here than we intend. So I hope that Senator Dahl would support that change and that the members would as well.
Ms. Pontius, your thoughts on a person?
Well, Madam Chair and members, it's used inconsistently in the statutes, and sometimes it's defined and sometimes it isn't. But I've always interpreted person to mean any kind of legal entity. So it would be both an individual corporation, a limited liability company, you know, whatever. So I don't think that part of the amendment adds anything. But obviously you've got the current law, and then you've got the new language on 22 to 24, which I think is more of Senator Ortman's concern.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheib.
Madam Chair, and to Senator Ortman, I think that current law anticipates that that means the entity today, that it means the corporation, the bank, which and this is banking law. So I think that those officers, directors, agents, and employees who violate this portion of the law, I think that's originally intended to cover them. I mean, I think
that's right.
So I think that instead of just because person apparently isn't defined in this section, I still think though that there isn't, it doesn't appear someplace where we know what it means. We know it means a corporation or other entity. So,
well, members, I think that the current law, without the new language, is intended to be applicable to all of those listed in their capacities. And I think Senator Ortman might be saying that if this new language in that section is put in place, might we want to think about whether or not it is now appropriate to apply that new language to everybody that's in current law. Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, that's exactly my point. And we previously had a criminal penalty. Well, we don't have a criminal penalty anymore, and it made sense. If it's a criminal penalty, it's people who are violating, but now you can have an entity. And so I think that we hold the entity responsible and not the employees. And what we're talking about now is damages, and we're talking about financial liability. We're not talking about a criminal penalty, and I don't think that the actions of the entity, should they be liable for $1 million, should lead to judgments and garnishments of wages from their former employees who were employed by this entity. So I think that because of this shift of this section out of the previous section, I think it makes sense for us to redefine this and define who it's going to be applicable to, and I think a person is sufficient here.
So, Senator Ortman, your motion would be
To revise subdivision 6 to read a person.
So reinstate the deleted language.
Yep, a person. And then take out everything from an individual all the way through employees. And then amend to add the word an S at violate, to make that plural, violates or participates, then S again. That would be my motion, and that would be the first issue for me in this section, Madam Chair.
Discussion on Senator Ortman's oral amendment. Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, that's acceptable, and we appreciate you bringing your concerns on that language.
Okay. And if seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ortman, did you have something else?
I do, Madam Chair, but I defer to Senator Limmer if he's...
All right, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to ask the author, Mr. Elwood, what the justification is for changing the language may be liable to is liable. I think maybe is sufficient everywhere else, so I'm wondering why the change.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I think the intent was simply to strengthen the deterrence against violating the Payday Lending Act, which... There are some prohibitions regarding using one loan to pay off the other, for example, and some other things in there. And the intent was simply to, if there's a violation, that there should be, the folks should be held liable, responsible for it.
Madam Senator Ormond.
That creates strict liability where I think under most of our statutes we don't do that. You still have to prove all of the elements, and I think that this takes us a step further than I'm comfortable with, and I'd like to see us reinstate the language may be and take out the word is. I think that is more consistent with everything else we've done in consumer protection. All those statutes say may be and not is, and well, so, Madam Chair, I would make that motion as well.
So Senator Ormond has moved to reinstate the stricken language. Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, and I guess I have to figure out, although it's changing the maybe to an is, it's also changing the reference on page 2.22. It's striking out 56.19, and it's changing the liability of 47.601, and that may have been covered, but what's the effect of changing the statutory reference, whether it's is or may be?
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, the penalties under 5619 are kind of inapplicable to these kinds of things, and now that we're creating some additional requirements, it seemed much more, and we're creating very specific remedies for these specific problems, it made more sense to refer to that. And to Senator Ortman's concern, I'm not sure that changing maybe to is creates strict liability. I think you still need to prove up the elements of it. I don't think that it creates strict liability. But maybe Ms. Pontius can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and I that's how I would read it as well. I don't think there's any strict liability created. It doesn't say is liable automatically. It says in the same manner as in Section 47.601. So I think it just clarifies that, you know, that there is liability, as there would be under this section, and takes out some potentially confusing language or ambiguous language if you say may be liable. I don't know that it really makes a big difference. It probably amounts to the same thing, but I think it just makes it clear what the intent of this would be.
Well, Madam Chair?
Ms. Elwood?
Well, Madam Chair, members, I think regardless of whether it is or may be, you still have to, the plaintiff still has to prove that there's been a violation.
Ms. Elwood, 47.601 is a really big section, and it deals with the definition of what a short-term loan is, deals with consumer short-term loan contract. Sure. It's got the debt collection, criminal prosecution, record keeping, jurisdiction, and the penalty section. Do you mean to reference subdivision 7 that deals with, or I mean, is there a particular subdivision, or is it all of that entire statutory section? Selwood?
Madam Chair, it is subdivision 7. You're absolutely right.
Okay, so, Senator Ortman, if that were sub 7, does that tighten it up for you?
Well, Madam Chair, I think it corrects the reference here, but I still prefer the language may be liable because I don't want a judge to make some determinations here where a jury might be asked those same questions, and I think the may be actually provides that. As we do in some other cases. So I wouldn't want to take it out of the province of the jury. I'd want to keep it there. So I prefer maybe as opposed to is.
Any further discussions on that? Okay, Senator Ormond has moved that we reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language. Ms. Pontius, do you have other technical suggestions for that?
Madam Chair, members, I was just going to suggest on line, page 2, line 23, delete such and insert the.
The for the violation. And then on line 2.22, insert subdivision 7. Yeah. Any other?
Senator Ortman, will you incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson?
I just wonder if we could vote on those separately.
Sure. Okay, so we'll vote. Senator Ortman's motion will be just to reinstate the current language on line 2.21 and strike the new language. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
The motion does not prevail. All right. Now, Senator Olson moves to insert on line 2.22 before the period, insert subdivision 7. And line 2.23, delete such a and insert the word the. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Can I ask one more question? And that would be the distinction between the damages that are available, damages and remedies available under 325F.69 and the remedies available under 8.31 to the private plaintiff. What would the difference in remedies be?
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, there are some advantages to take an 8.31 action and some advantages to take this action. The differences would be under Section 8.31, you would have damages plus investigative costs, but you wouldn't have all the additional, you wouldn't have the statutory damages that are available under Section 601 remedies. So it's kind of a choice of the plaintiff which action to take.
Ms. Dell, will remind us again, 325F.69 is what?
Madam Chair, members, is the Consumer Fraud Act.
Right, and Madam Chair, my question is, what are the remedies available under the Consumer Fraud Act? Because I think that it includes some of the remedies in the 8.31 provision.
So what it says, a violation of any provision of this section is considered to be a violation of 325F.69. So any violation is a violation under that. Are there separate remedies under that violation?
Madam Chair, members, the consumer, it's kind of a connect the dots thing. If you violate Consumer Fraud Act, a plaintiff would have a private remedy under Section 8.31 for violation of Section 325F69. That's how it works.
Right. But, Madam Chair, my point is that without 8.31, there are still remedies available under 325F.69, and that's my question. What's available under that statute so we can see if they need to be supplemented by what's available under 8.31?
Right. So, Ms. Elwood, now you understand the question?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I apologize. I didn't understand the question. Now I do. The only remedies, if you don't, the Consumer Fraud Act by itself, the only remedies are injunctive relief.
And then what are all the remedies under Section 8.31, Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and members, you would have damages plus reasonable attorney's fees plus investigative costs.
And Ms. Elwood, that will be on top of the remedies at 47.01601 subdivision 7?
Madam Chair, arguably you could use both, but generally you'd be choosing one or the other.
Well, does the statute say you could choose one or the other, or does it leave it open to use both?
Madam Chair, it says the remedies are cumulative and does not restrict any remedies, so arguably you could use both.
Arguably.
Well, I guess I'm not comfortable with being so broad, Ms. Elwood. What was the intent here?
Madam Chair, there has been a movement over the last several years to incorporate some of the newer provisions that newer consumer protection laws that came in after Section 8.31 was enacted to incorporate those under that rubric. But I think that we'd be comfortable if we'd leave the remedies under subdivision 7. If you feel It's a little overreaching, and just to strike the
new language.
The language in section two.
Okay.
I don't think we'd have a problem with that.
I think that would ease some of our concerns in this committee.
Well,
and then we could have a separate
Chair,
conversation on that.
If that eases your
day.
Concerns, so
yeah.
We would be delighted.
So let's see. Senator Olson, are you willing to move the deletion of that new language? Or Senator Scheid?
Well, I was comfortable with it where it was.
Okay, you were.
I was too, Madam Chair.
Cumulative, Madam Chair, members.
I think about it this way, Madam Chair. You know, when we have violations of the law in the area of discrimination, for example, I mean, there are different avenues that a person can pursue under state law or federal law, and there are different damages, different remedies, some advantages in a given case to going one way or the other. And it's not uncommon that situation is there where you might have an election of remedies. But considering how I feel about, I guess, the idea of payday lending and giving, if someone violates these very minimal standards that we're putting into law, some of us think they should go much farther. Having some election of remedies available doesn't bother me at all.
Well, I don't think it's an election of remedies here. That's why Mr. Elwood just clarified. If it were a situation, an election of different types of remedies, that would be a different story, but this is cumulative. So you get to have a shot. You get to go after all of these remedies, and getting the one doesn't exclude you from getting the other. I think there's an issue of balance and fairness here, unless members don't think so. Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Council and I both just looked at this, and I'm not sure we need to reference 325F.69 at all. We can just provide the remedies under 8.31, because under the consumer fraud statute, the only remedy available is injunctive relief, as you've said yourself. That's also available under 8.31, so I'm not sure why we need to have both.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I think you need to look at subdivision 3A.
Of which statute?
8.31, subdivision 3A, which provides the actual individual action. It's known as the Private Attorney General's Act.
Right. Mr.
Yeah.
Chair and Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ortman?
Mr. Elwood, I did.
Oh.
And what I'm saying is there's injunctive relief available there, so you don't need a reference to 325F.69, which is limited to an injunctive relief. I'm not sure why we're calling this a violation of that. Just provide the remedy.
Well, it will be the will of the committee. My concern is that there's, I think we ought to consider the, if we want a particular type of remedy, we should make sure that that remedy, that we're creating alternatives as opposed to kind of the piling on factor. And we're the Judiciary Committee, and I think we ought to stay balanced in how we do this. If in other cases we're not piling on or it's not cumulative, if we want to draft this as being alternative, I think that we should do that. But if it's a cumulative, I'm not sure that's – I mean, maybe this happens in other areas of the law. I don't know. But I'm just not comfortable with that. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Elwood, if we did take that last sentence out and we just said that a person is going to be liable in the same manner as Section 47.601, what would be the remedies available to a person under that section?
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, then I think we would move to Subdivision 7 and everything that's available under especially since you've already made the amendment to clarify that it's Subdivision 7. So I think there is some substantial and adequate remedies under Subdivision 7.
Madam Chair, then I guess I would withdraw as long as my objection and support your amendment.
Does it take out the last sentence, right?
I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman,
is the amendment to take out the last sentence?
Yes.
I would definitely support that, Madam Chair.
So Senator Ortman moves the deletion of the new language on line 2.22, starting with the word A to the end of the sentence, and then deleting line 23 and 24. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, do we adopt the A6 amendment?
Not yet.
Okay. I'll move the A6 amendment.
Senator Betzel moves the A6 amendment. It has already been explained to us. All those in favor? Senator Limmer.
Limmer.
I know.
Chair, I had a question on line of the amendment, 1.9. That's removing the criminal prosecution provision. And I was wondering, why are we doing that?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, we're not actually removing criminal prosecution. What we were saying is that's subdivision 4, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. First of all, the intent of that section was to prevent lenders, especially the internet ones, which we know are prone to do it, to threaten people by criminal prosecution for essentially taking a payday loan. Because when you take a payday loan and you're writing a check for money you don't have in the bank, because it's 2 weeks hence, it's a post-dated check. And so we know that there are many unscrupulous lenders. If the money 2 weeks later isn't in the bank account, they will threaten these folks to throw them in jail. And so the intent of this section was essentially about the threat. The way it was drafted, however, and it's our fault, not counsel, it was drafted essentially to say you can't criminally prosecute someone under Section 609.535, but the reality is you can't do that anyway because you can't prosecute somebody for a post-dated check. For failure, so it doesn't. It didn't really get to the intent of what we were trying to do, and it seemed to make the most sense to just delete it. We actually have arrived at our intent, however, because in subdivision 3, by applying the debt collection standards, one of the standards is you cannot threaten somebody to throw them in jail for this kind of civil debt. So we've achieved our goal, but this is kind of superfluous.
Any further discussions on the A6 amendment? I don't think is there anything substantive in the A6 amendment that people need to testify on? Does anybody here want to speak on the A6 amendment? All those in favor of the A6 amendment as moved by Senator Betzel, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, on Senate File 806, as amended, anybody else here who would like to speak on Senate File 806, as amended? See none. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 806, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to get this in. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate it very much. Thanks.
You know, members, these kind of bills, sometimes they make me a little bit, how do I say it? I feel like I have a split personality. Because on the one hand, I think the liberal heart in me says that we have to do this to protect people who are vulnerable. The disadvantaged soul in me feels like sometimes when you're down and out and there just ain't nothing else available for you, at least there's one place that's available. And sometimes regulating the industry may make us feel good that we're doing something good, whether people are asking us to do that on their behalf or not. But we may also at the same time be shutting down a door to the only avenue that anybody has. I come from a very big extended family, and I think if I was down and out $50, I could call up one of my many, many, many cousins, and somebody would give me $50. But in reality, in this society today, there are a lot of people who don't have a ton of cousins or relatives to turn to. And maybe these kind of services may be their only uncle. And so I have mixed feelings about how overbroad and how overreaching we can be, that in our quest to do good, we may also do some unintended damages that put people in some pretty tight spots. And if we put them in such a tight spot that they have to go and rob a grocery store to get the $50 they need, I don't know that we're necessarily helping society very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I just might, I guess I am repeating myself, but when I talked about the action in the Commerce Committee, I think that was really the sentiment of the Commerce Committee and why the bill is pared down to what it is, but it's still, I think, an important first step, particularly the reporting and finding out what is happening with people doing many, many loans or just doing a few a year. I agree. I didn't want to shut this industry down because it really is the only source. And we want the people who are in Minnesota who have, a footprint here, who are a face over a counter or whatever in their business, are still able to conduct this important service, if you will, and not just put people in peril on the internet in an unregulated environment. So I agree 100% with you.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I'm hoping that we can get at this in a different way in the Tax Committee. It's one of the ways to do it is to address these interest rates that are so high, and these organizations in particular charge extremely high interest rates.
I do.
Well, members, we have taken care of all the bills from members who are not part of the committee. We're at a juncture where we could take a break and come back and go through our committee bills. The rest of the bills on the agenda are member bills. And I think that some of them should go fairly quickly. I don't anticipate that we would be here longer than maybe, like, if we took an hour break, maybe it'll take us an hour and a half, so at the most we'll be here till 9 if you want to take an hour for dinner. We should do that to give council an opportunity to look over the rest of the bills if we have any remaining amendments that has to be addressed. So that we're kind of done after today, and so I certainly don't want to have to lay any of this over for any other time or have to delay us anymore. So let's take an hour recess for dinner break. We'll be back at 7 o'clock on the dot, and we'll process the rest of the bills. We're in recess.